Here's a Vietnam War story seldom told. Shortly after Saigon fell to the North Vietnamese and the last Americans left South Vietnam, a small U.S. Navy warship headed back to rescue tens of thousands of refugees. Recently, the men of that ship, the destroyer escort USS Kirk, met for a reunion. They were reunited, too, with some of the Vietnamese people they helped save. NPR's Joseph Shapiro interviewed more than 20 eyewitnesses, studied documents that tell the history of the Kirk, and attended that reunion held outside Washington, D.C.
At the door of a ballroom, there's a man with a graying beard in a white sailor's hat. And even though it's summer, he wears the heavy wool, dark blue winter uniform of the U.S. Navy. The man snaps to attention with a crisp salute when he spots who he's been waiting for. An old man in a wheelchair being pushed down the hall by his wife and children. The sailors waited 35 years to be reunited with this man and his family.
Hello, sir. My name's Kent Chipman. You're the pilot of the Big Chinook. Nice to meet you, sir.
Kent Chipman was once a sailor in the U.S.
Thank
Navy.
Ban Nguyen
was a pilot in the South Vietnamese Army. On April 29, 1975, as Saigon fell, they crossed paths for one brief moment. Mina Nguyen Driver is the pilot's daughter.
In 1975, I was a 10-month-old, and I obviously don't remember anything just because I was still a baby in diapers. But what my mom tells me, my parents tell me, is that they dropped me off.
That's not like drop off the baby at daycare or drop off the baby at grandma's house. What she means is that her mother dropped her from a moving helicopter.
And she just was like, one, two, three, hallelujah, drop her. And just, you know, going for Hail Mary and not really quite sure as to if the folks below were going to catch me or not.
The folks about 10 feet below were that sailor, Kent Chipman, and his crewmates on the USS Kirk.
I remember the baby coming out, but, you know, there was no way we're going to let him hit the deck or drop him. We caught him.
That's how desperate things were for families like Ban Nguyen's. As Saigon fell, the Vietnamese pilot gathered his family in his helicopter and flew away from the city. The only direction to go was out to sea. He was running out of fuel when he spotted a solitary ship below. It was the Kirk. But the ship was too small and the helicopter too large to land. So Nguyen hovered above the deck while his passengers, including his wife and three small children, jumped. The 260 men on the Kirk did even grander things than that. As the rest of the U.S. Navy was steaming out of Vietnam, the Kirk went back by itself and rescued Vietnamese refugees. But it's untold history. It just wasn't something people wanted to talk about 35 years ago.
People put the Vietnam War, or at least wanted to put the Vietnam War, behind them.
Jan Herman is an historian with the U.S. Navy. He's documenting the Kirk's great humanitarian mission in a film and a book.
It was a time to forget a very unhappy war and to move on. And so the story of the Kirk, as good as it was kind of left in the dust. No one really looked at it.
The Kirk rescued and then escorted 20 to 30,000 refugees to safety. About half were women, children, and babies. The crew fed them, gave them fresh water, and cared for the sick. In the war, the ship never did see combat. The Kirk was a submarine hunter, its crew trained for warfare. So the sailors found it hard to think of their humanitarian work as heroic.
It's certainly not something you go bragging about to your fellow warriors. I diapered a baby today. No, I'm not sure that that's going to go over well at a, you know, at a bar when you're having a brew with a bunch of friends or colleagues.
It's not just the rest of the world that didn't know about the Kirk. The Navy didn't know either. Paul Jacobs, the captain of the Kirk, talked about that oversight at the recent reunion.
We have a bunch of officers, enlisted men on board the Kirk that never got their Vietnamese service medal. So if you'd please come up here, I'm going to ask the Admiral if he wouldn't mind pinning that on them.
Several years ago, men from the Kirk applied for a new service medal that was being given to sailors who'd taken part in the helicopter evacuation of Saigon. The Navy couldn't find a record that the Kirk was even there. It took until recently to clear up that bureaucratic mess.
The reason the Kirk is so compelling, the reason
Vice Admiral
the
Adam Robinson, the Navy Surgeon General, has come to the reunion to give those service ribbons and to recognize the Kirk's humanitarian mission.
The reason that we are here tonight is to celebrate that ethos of service.
One way the crew of the Kirk is making their story known is by holding reunions like this one.
They want to find out what happened to the Vietnamese that they rescued, and the Vietnamese want to pay their respects to the people who rescued them.
Captain Jacobs says the men of the Kirk better understand the importance of what they did when they hear the success stories of the people they saved.
Do you remember when all the Vietnamese were assembled on the hill and the Kirk came steaming in there everybody was waving their arms?
I know that. I remember in the morning.
Tin Pham was captain of one of the Vietnamese ships crammed with refugees. He moved his ship behind the Kirk and followed for 6 days until they got to the Philippines. But the captains, Jacobs and Pham, had never met each other until this moment.
Even though I never have a chance to meet him before, he's very famous. I know him, but I didn't.
There are many joyous reunions tonight, like with Bon Nguyen, the Vietnamese pilot, and his wife, son, and daughter, who jumped from the helicopter.
Now, the last thing we're going to give the good skipper.
The Kirk crew had long forgotten the name of this helicopter pilot, but they never forgot his stunning airmanship. So last year, Captain Jacobs looked for him, and tonight, the captain and his crew are honoring Bon Nguyen.
That, to me, is what he did in 1975 to free those people was above and beyond. Great job. Let's give him a hand.
The old man is pushed in his wheelchair by his son to the front of the ballroom. An officer from the Kirk pins an air medal on the man's sport coat. It's a version of the one the U.S. military gives for heroic feats while flying. The audience rises to its feet. It hasn't been clear how much Bon Nguyen understands. He has Alzheimer's. He doesn't speak anymore, but he frequently cries out.
Congratulations. Well done. Very well done.
Then the old pilot struggles to get out of his wheelchair. His son hurries to his side and helps him up. Bon Nguyen lifts his shaking arm and brings it to his head in a salute. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
You can see video and photos of the USS Kirk, read a timeline of its mission, and hear more tales from the sailors and refugees at NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Yesterday, we brought you the story of one of the most extraordinary humanitarian missions in the history of the U.S. military. It's a story that had long been forgotten, lost in the bitterness over the Vietnam War. It begins when Saigon fell in April of 1975. The crew of a small U.S. Navy ship, the destroyer escort USS Kirk, got orders to protect U.S. Marine helicopters as they evacuated the last Americans and thousands of Vietnamese allies. But that wasn't the Kirk's most daring mission. Correspondent Joseph Shapiro with NPR's investigative unit interviewed more than 20 eyewitnesses and pored over hundreds of documents to tell the history of the Kirk. Here's the second part of his report.
As the evacuation of Saigon was winding down, the USS Kirk got a strange order to head back to Vietnam and to go alone. It was just before midnight, the night of April 30th, 1975, and there was one more thing. The Kirk would be taking orders from a young civilian.
I was put on a small boat and transferred from the Blue Ridge over to the Kirk, and it was then as the middle of the night.
Richard Armitage had just turned 30 that week. He was on assignment from the Secretary of Defense. He came aboard wearing a borrowed blue sport coat.
I went into the officer's mess, and Commodore Roan was there along with Captain Jacobs. And Commodore Roan said, "Young man, I'm not used to having strange civilians come aboard my ship in the middle of the night and give me orders." I said, "I'm equally unaccustomed, sir, to coming aboard strange ships in the middle of the night and giving you orders, but it's deemed a Con Son," and so they did.
Con Son was the site of a notorious South Vietnamese prison. Now its harbors were the gathering point for what was left of South Vietnam's Navy. Armitage needed the Kirk to save those ships. It was a plan he'd put together with an old friend, Captain Kim Do, a senior Vietnamese Navy officer.
Mr. Richard Armitage, he came and he told me that we need a plan to evacuate the Vietnamese Navy. I said, no way, because it would be very dangerous for us.
Armitage had been a Navy intelligence officer assigned to Vietnamese units. He got fluent in the language, but he'd quit the Navy in protest when the Nixon administration signed the Paris Peace Accords. That agreement, 2 years earlier, ended direct U.S. military involvement. Armitage thought the U.S. had sold out the South Vietnamese. Years later, Armitage would be Colin Powell's top deputy at the State Department. But as the South Vietnamese government was falling, he'd returned as a civilian with an assignment from the Pentagon to save Navy technology.
To keep it from falling into the hands of the enemy. Now, if you could get it out to Thailand, good. Good. If not, sink it, scuttle it, do what you need to do.
The U.S. wanted those Vietnamese ships kept away from the communists. But Captain Doe had warned Armitage they'd be saving a lot more than the ships.
I told him, I said that, well, our crew would not leave Saigon without their family. So therefore, there would be a lot of people. He kept silent on that subject. He didn't say yes, he didn't say no. So I just take it as an acknowledgement.
In the Kirk's radar room, Jim Bongard was on duty.
So anyway, all of a sudden, plows the course for Khon San Island. So where the heck is Khon San Island? I don't know what it was. Just pulled out a chart and we figured out what, you know, the plot we're going to go, and off we went. And all of a sudden, the fleet's over here fading off the scope, and we're going this way. And I'm going, we're heading back to Vietnam, guys, by ourselves. At that point, we knew something was really going to be weird.
The Kirk reached Khon San just as the sun was coming up.
All these ships were out there, and they were just packed to the gills with evacuees.
Hugh Doyle was the Kirk's chief engineer. He made cassette tapes to send home to his wife. Today, they're one of the best records of what happened. They've never been heard publicly until now.
Peasants, Navy people, fishermen, everything. They had come, and they all had gathered from all up and down the coast. They had all gathered at Khon San Island.
Some records say there were 20,000 people on those ships. Historians for the U.S. Navy use the number 30,000. They were crowded on more than 30 Vietnamese Navy ships, a couple dozen rickety fishing boats, and a few large cargo ships. One cargo ship was so heavy it was sinking. People below deck were bailing out the water with their shoes. The passengers had to be moved to another ship, crossing over on a narrow wooden plank.
Young woman wasn't moving fast enough or panicked or whatever, and she stopped.
Stephen Burwinkle saw what happened next.
And this guy behind her pushed her and pushed her down.
The woman fell into the ocean, then was rescued.
And I thought, oh boy, we're going to have trouble here. This Vietnamese lieutenant did not hesitate. He went right up the back of that guy, took his gun out and shot him in the head, killed him. He came over the side, stopped all the trouble right then and there.
It was up to the crew of the Kirk to keep order. The Kirk's mechanics got engines running on rusted ships. The crew supplied food and fresh water. And Burwinkle went from ship to ship to check on the sick and injured. He was the Kirk's medic. In the Navy, it's called a hospital corpsman.
One mother, I remember, brought me her baby, and I thought the baby was, quite frankly, dead.
The child, a boy just a week old, was listless but alive. He had pneumonia.
I didn't know what to do, really. I had some penicillin with me. Of course, I was aboard the Vietnamese ship. You know, I gave it this massive dose of penicillin, thinking, well, it's either going to be right or wrong. The child was going to die anyway.
Only the child didn't die, as Burwinkle had expected. The corpsman's desperate treatment had worked. But a couple days later, as Burwinkle was making his rounds, he got an urgent call to come back to the Kirk.
He said, I think the baby's dead. I said, what do you mean? The child was doing fine.
The baby had choked on formula. It was a freakish accident.
And because of his compromised condition, it was just too much for his system, and he died of cardiac arrest. And I remember we had a, excuse me just a minute, we had a funeral for him, a burial at sea. It's very emotional. Still brings back emotions that I'd rather not have.
The crew gathered the child's father and three siblings for a funeral on the Kirk. The captain said a prayer. A bugler played taps. The child's body was wrapped in a yellow and red South Vietnamese flag and dropped into the ocean. The ship sailed to the Philippines. Of the 20 to 30,000 refugees escorted by the Kirk over 6 days, only three died. Hugh Doyle, recording a cassette to his wife, thought it was extraordinary, given the grim living conditions.
You should see the sicknesses. You know, some of these small ships with thousands of people on them have widespread conjunctivitis, you know, in the eyes. They have diarrhea, dysentery, all basic malnutrition, dehydration.
The Kirk became a maternity ward for five pregnant women close to giving birth. Captain Paul Jacobs moved them into the enlisted men's lounge. Jacobs, who knew how to take charge but keep things light too, checked on them often. His message was clear, even though he addressed them through a Vietnamese interpreter.
So I take this wrench and I wrap it against the bulkhead. You realize that if one of you has a baby on board, that's a U.S. citizen, that's your meal ticket to the United States. But it got them laughing and got them thinking about what could happen. See?
Lan Tran was 18 years old, the wife of a Vietnamese military pilot.
They put me in the big room with other four pregnant women and their family. The next morning, captain come over, knock the door, and then smiling and say, "Hey, hurry, hurry, lady," because he want a baby name after USS Kirk. Okay, so he say, "Hurry." They treat us very kindly and took good care of us.
The next day, other U.S. Navy ships joined the escort. But it's clear from the daily logs for the ships that the crew of the Kirk took the lead. After sailing 4 days, the ships were getting close to their destination in the Philippines. That's when Captain Jacobs got word that President Ferdinand Marcos was blocking their entry.
The Philippine government wasn't going to allow us in, period. Because these ships belonged to the North Vietnamese now, and they didn't want to offend the new country.
It was Richard Armitage and Captain Kim Do who came up with a solution to transfer ownership of the vessels.
We talked back and forth, and then I proposed a solution that we will raise the American flag and lower the Vietnamese flag as a sign of transfer the ship back to the United States. Because during the war, those ships are given to the Vietnamese government as a loan, if you want, from the United States to fight the communists. Now the war is over. We turn them back to the United States.
Officers from the Kirk were sent aboard every ship to take command from the Vietnamese captains.
Their country was gone. Our job was to treat it with dignity.
Rick Sauter was one of those officers from the Kirk.
That was the last vestige of South Vietnam. And when those flags came down and the American flags went up, that was it. Because a Navy ship is sovereign territory. And so that was the last sovereign territory of the Republic of Vietnam.
Captain Kim Do.
Thousands of people on the boat start to sing the national anthem when they lower their flag. And they cry, cry, cry.
Thuy Hugo, a young teacher, was on one of the ships.
And we knew that we are no longer belong to them. That we all cry, singing our national anthem. Công dân ơi, quốc gia đến ngày giải phóng, đồng lòng cùng đi hy sinh tiếc gì thân sống, vì tương lai quốc dân cùng sống pha khoái tên. Làm sao cho núi sông từ nay luôn vững bền. And also stand still to salute and raise up the American flag, which is, that's the flag, it saved our life.
The Vietnamese military officers took off their hats, ripped the stripes off their uniforms, and threw them into the sea. On May 7th, the ships were allowed into Subic Bay. For the refugees, there'd still be a long ways to go. They take other ships to Guam, eventually most resettled in the United States.
I don't know what you've been reading in the news. I don't know how much of a play this evacuation of the Vietnamese Navy is getting, but the whole thing was kind of cool in the way we did it.
What Hugh Doyle and the men of the Kirk didn't know was that there'd been no coverage in the U.S.
I heard that there was a comment made by Radio Hanoi on the other night about an American destroyer who flagrantly stole the Vietnamese Navy. If you saw that comment, that was USS Kirk. we were the ones that grabbed it.
It was the USS Kirk that grabbed the South Vietnamese Navy and started the rescue of 20 to 30,000 refugees on a humanitarian mission that was forgotten until now. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
You can see video and photos of the Kirk, read a timeline of its mission, and hear more tales from the sailors and refugees at npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Here's a question a Chicago street artist continues to ask as he faces prison for recording his own arrest. If the government can record us, why can't we record the government? NPR's Cheryl Corley has the story.
This case in Chicago, where an artist is charged with violating the state's eavesdropping law, actually began as civil disobedience. As a group of kids drummed on buckets on Chicago's State Street, Chris Drew stood nearby. It was late December, lots of holiday crowds, and Drew was dressed for attention in a blazing red poncho covered with art patches that he was selling for a dollar each. Drew is a free speech advocate, and his State Street appearance was part of an ongoing protest of a Chicago law restricting where artists can sell their wares. When a Chicago police officer noticed him in the off-limits area, he told him to move along.
Can't sell stuff
out here, buddy. Drew was hoping to get arrested to test the city's law, and he got his wish. Prosecutors charged him with two misdemeanors. He was not expecting what came next. After police found a small recording device in his belongings, Drew was charged with a felony for violating the Illinois eavesdropping law, which requires all involved to consent to any audio recording.
And shortly thereafter, they put a bond of $20,000 on me for selling art for a dollar on State Street and audio taping my own arrest.
The misdemeanor charges were dropped, but the felony charge remains, and with it a possible 4 to 15 year prison term. Eavesdropping and wiretap laws were designed to protect private conversations. So the question becomes, what's private and what's not? In 12 states, including Illinois, recording the audio of an on-duty officer in a public place without consent could be considered illegal and perceived violations likely to be played out in court, like in a case in Massachusetts. 3 years ago, lawyer Simon Glick flipped open his cell phone and recorded some Boston police officers he thought were using excessive force in an encounter with a young man. Glick ended up being arrested when an officer asked if he had recorded any sound, and Glick replied yes. Sarah Wunsch, an attorney with the Massachusetts ACLU, argues the state law is not being interpreted correctly.
To say that in the United States of America, this would be considered a crime to record is crazy. You know, if the police can record a stop, the ordinary citizen needs to be able to observe and record what's going on in a public place. There is no right to privacy of the police officers in that context.
Then there's the controversial case of Anthony Graber, a 25-year-old motorcyclist who was speeding along an interstate in Maryland earlier this year, his helmet camera rolling. When he came to a stop at an exit, a state trooper in plain clothes and an unmarked car blocked his access and approached Graber, gun in hand.
Get off the motorcycle. Get off the motorcycle. Get off the motorcycle. State police.
Graber was ticketed, but after he posted the encounter on YouTube, authorities got a warrant, seized his camera and computers, and the Harford County prosecutor, Joseph Cassily, charged him with three felonies for violating the state's wiretap law.
If you don't make the tape public, then the government really wouldn't know that you had made a recording.
Even so, Cassily says he disagrees with the law. He calls it too broad and says it criminalizes the conduct of citizens. But he says there is another side to consider.
Police officers need to do a job where often they need to take statements or information from people that are reluctant to talk to the officer and reluctant to give information to the officer.
And that, says Cassily, means police conversations with witnesses or victims should be private. He suggests, and others have called for, a rewrite of Maryland's law. An attempt to revise the Illinois statute failed a few years ago. Now it's being challenged in federal court. Harvey Grossman with the ACLU of Illinois argues it's unconstitutional.
The general theme that
drifts through these cases is very clear. Law enforcement is rebelling and is refusing to allow public scrutiny of their behavior, and they're using the eavesdropping statute as a weapon against civilians.
And with a proliferation of cell phones and ever smaller recording devices, more cases involving just who gets to record what's said between police and civilians will likely end up in court. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
Baseball is on the mind of sports commentator Frank DeFord this week, specifically one major league player who's been extraordinary in his consistency.
We usually wait for milestones to salute excellence, but every now and then it's worth just pausing to admire some athlete who is unique, who does something spectacular, but does it day after week after year. So, like that, may we now sing the praises of Ichiro Suzuki as he completes his 10th season in American baseball. No, it's not as if Ichiro is ignored, unsung. He's not only been an MVP, but he's made the All-Star team every season, and he holds the Major League record with 9 straight 200-hit seasons. But then Ichiro is on a losing team in Seattle. He hasn't appeared in the postseason in 9 years, and he plays out there, up there, in what most of the media considers Baja Yukon. The fact is, though, that Ichiro is probably better at the task of putting a bat on a pitched ball than anyone ever in history. Only at a time when first home runs and then pitching have been fashionable, what he does is like singing Gilbert and Sullivan when everybody is listening to rock. If he were a basketball player, Ichiro would be shooting set shots. If he were a football player, he would be drop kicking. Ichiro just brings the bat around, raises his leg, and pivots in his peculiar fashion, and then he makes contact and sends the ball to an empty place. If he isn't injured, he will easily reach 200 hits again this season. Only Pete Rose did that 10 times, and it took him 17 years. Ichiro will be 10 for 10. He has 2,200 hits in our major leagues. He made 1,400 hits in the Japanese majors. In case you want to suggest that he feasted on weak pitching over there, well, Ichiro actually averages more hits per game here than he did in Japan. He just hits pitchers. Ichiro makes a little more than 1 1/3 hits a game, whoever is pitching, wherever, whatever time of day. Altogether, at age 36, he has more than 3,600 hits, about 600 fewer than Rose's American record. He'll probably end up with a total of 5,000 safe hits in Major League play. And, of course, Ichiro is a significant cultural figure. As the first Japanese position player and the first big star to jump to the U.S., he opened up the American game to Asians, made our national pastime truly worldwide, even if he can't get into the World Series himself. Our provincial Hall of Fame does not recognize Japanese baseball stars like Sadahara Oh, the home run champion. But they can't keep Ichiro out of Cooperstown. No, maybe he's not the best player of his era, but then he may do better at what he does best than any other athlete of his time. And he made an international difference.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This has been the hottest summer on record in many East Coast cities and many other parts of the country. That heat has brought with it a lot of days with unhealthy air. At least 75 areas from Portland, Maine to San Francisco are warning residents to expect high air pollution today. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Shogren with our report.
All the bad air days mean that at daycare centers like Little Flowers in Washington, D.C., children are spending a lot of time cooped up inside.
And now we're taking them outside for 15 minutes so they can play with the sprinkler.
Ileana Noguchi says the children normally would go to the playground several times a day for 40 minutes each time. But with Code Red air quality, they get one short recess.
Ready? Go! Who's going to be the brave one? Come on, let's go!
As tiny feet slap the pavement in a happy sprinkler dance, Noguchi says some toddlers are missing. They have asthma, and their parents pick them up early to avoid even this brief time outside. Norman Edelman, the chief medical officer for the American Lung Association, says children are especially vulnerable to bad air days, particularly if they have asthma.
Kids are always running around, so they breathe a lot more for their size than adults do. So they take in more of this bad stuff.
That means that even healthy children should limit their time outside on code orange days when the air is unhealthy for sensitive groups and on code red days when the air is bad for everyone. Ozone and fine particles are the two types of pollution that trigger code red and orange days. Both are formed out of the exhaust from power plants, cars, and a lot of other things. Edelman says with ozone,
the two bad chemical actors are oxides of nitrogen and hydrocarbons. When they're exposed to heat and sunlight, a chemical reaction takes place which releases ozone.
And when people breathe it in, it irritates their lungs.
So if you look down the airway of somebody exposed to excessive ozone, it would look like a bad sunburn of the airways.
And since children's airways are a lot smaller than adults, it doesn't take much swelling to cause an asthma attack. High levels of fine particles also trigger bad air days in summertime, especially in the east. Coal-fired power plants are the main culprit, and on the hottest days, they're working at full tilt to keep air conditioners running. The elderly and people with lung and heart problems are at high risk, but Edelman says even if you're healthy, you shouldn't ignore bad air days. It's probably best to do outdoor exercise in the morning before the sun and exhaust have turned the air into an unhealthy soup. Not at, say, 5 p.m. when two teams of federal workers are slugging it out on a steamy softball field.
Come on, Dwight, come on.
So I know two other teams played it safe today and called the next two games off. So, and it's not that bad out here.
Army Corps of Engineers shortstop Matt Unger says his players are used to the heat after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, good.
Turns out their opponents, self-described bureaucrats from the Government Accountability Office, are pretty tough, too. Still panting from her run around the bases, Kim Giannopoulos admits that, like a lot of other people, she doesn't pay much attention to air pollution alerts.
You don't get too much opportunity these days to get out and have fun with your coworkers and do this kind of thing, so gotta take advantage of it, you know?
Dr. Edelman says if you do exert yourself on bad air days, don't ignore symptoms like burning lungs or irritated eyes. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Hawaii is suffering through an unprecedented drought. For half a century, there's been a downward trend in rainfall on the islands. The problem has now become more pronounced with a two-year dry spell that has fueled wildfires and destroyed crops. Hawaii Public Radio's Ben Marcus reports.
A month ago, Big Island resident Judy Hancock remembers turning to her husband at the dinner table and saying,
I'm really afraid about a fire at the scenic overlook because when I drove up from town yesterday, there are a bunch of dead trees and it looked so dry. And then he was on his way to Hilo, and I said, there's a fire, and he couldn't believe it.
Her lush green front yard stands in contrast now to the dry and charred land that surrounds it. The late July fire miraculously stopped short at a stone wall about 100 yards from her home atop Mount Kohala on the northern tip of the island.
It's so dry that it was just explosive, almost. You know, I mean, the fire just took off like mad.
The entire state is dry, but the Big Island, about 160 miles southeast of Honolulu, is ground zero for the drought. Kevin Kodama is a hydrologist for the National Weather Service. He says certain swaths of the Big Island are the driest in the country.
They were on pace to set all-time records for the driest year ever. And you're talking about stations that have over 50 years of record. So this is very unusual.
And costly, especially for the up to 60,000 people in Hawaii who depend on rain for fresh water. People like Robin Lamson, who lives on the southern tip of the Big Island. A 20,000-gallon steel-sided catchment tank sits in his backyard.
I don't have a gauge that works right now, but you start like this. I'm right there. I got a quarter of a tank left.
He estimates he's spent $600 more this year paying water haulers to fill the tank. He says this part of the island has always been relatively dry.
But we have not had more than 2 inches of rain in 9 months, and that's been a little sprinkle at a time, an eighth of an inch maybe. That's a heavy deluge now. And we used to get an inch sometimes, and you know, we'd wet everything down. Well, you look at the trees around, they're dying.
Crops are dying, too. The entire state has been designated an agricultural disaster area by the federal government. That enables farmers to apply for special loans. Loans that South Kona coffee grower Jason Stith is seriously considering. Stith pulls on a branch from one of the trees growing out of rocky, volcanic soil.
But if you can see how these beans are all, they're kind of like striated. They're not, they don't have a lot of mucilage or juice in them. They're dry. They should be full and plump, and they just aren't. You can see it even in the green cherry.
The ocean twinkles off in the distance, but despite this serene location, Stith says he felt depressed after picking coffee the other day. He estimates that 50% of the crop has been damaged by the drought.
I'm just amazed they hang on at all. I think it's the caffeine in the coffee that keeps them going. It just keeps them wound up. They don't know how to shut down, so...
The pain isn't just felt on the Big Island. Wildfires have charred parts of Maui, and on the east side of Oahu, mandatory water restrictions are in effect due to a critically low reservoir. And relief is still months away. The rainy season doesn't officially start until November. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.